This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
It's 12:03 Monday afternoon, October 7th. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the Noon Business Hour. I'm Rob Hart. There's pushback from customers as food companies cut the size or quality of their products, but not the price. We'll cover that in our next segment. But right now, the week ahead includes data on inflation and earnings, plus a deeper analysis of the government jobs report for September. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park Business Line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Tom Hudson, financial journalist based in Miami, Florida. Tom, thank you for joining us today. And before we get into the meat of the conversation, I know you're in Miami, but Milton looks like a big storm. So best of luck to you and everybody in Florida as the storm bears down.
Thank you. I will say here on the East Coast, on the southeast tip of Florida, we're in pretty good shape. But I know a lot of friends and family members in Sarasota, Tampa, Clearwater, St. Pete Beach. This is a monster storm. It's a Category 5 already. This is a storm that the Tampa Bay region has not experienced in more than a century.
And that's a good jumping off point to talk about the economic impact, not only of Milton as it bears down on Florida, churning away in the Gulf of Mexico right now, but the aftermath of Helene cutting a swath of damage, not only to the Big Bend area of Florida, but up through Georgia and into North Carolina. And what type of impact is that having on economic activity, and are we seeing that already?
Well, we're going to see it in some of those locations, particularly in western North Carolina, just simply because of the natural destruction that Helene wrought in those areas. It just suppresses all economic activity. Without the internet, you can't use your credit cards. You simply have no store to go to in many of these communities. So there is absolutely economic devastation in these communities, and some of it is going to take months, if not years, to recover from, if they ever are able to recover. We may see a blip when it comes to the national figures from the storm season, particularly with Hurricane Milton now and looking where it's going to go, to a major metropolitan area in Florida, but still way too early to be told, to be seen. We may see some impact perhaps on the October or November jobs numbers, for instance.
Now, we do have a couple of reports coming out this week that will give us some more thinking about future interest rate cuts. We have Producer Price Index, the Consumer Price Index, and then also we get the meetings, the minutes from the last Fed meeting in September, the one where they cut interest rates by half a point. And what story is that going to tell us this week?
I think the minutes are going to tell us about the conviction of the Federal Reserve toward continuing to march rates lower. Remember that the decision to cut interest rates was a foregone conclusion for weeks. The Federal Reserve and many of the regional bank presidents, including Chicago, President Goolsbee, had talked very openly that they were going to be cutting interest rates. So it wasn't a secret. The question remains, how long and how far are they willing to cut? And now you've got this really strong non-farms job payroll figure that came out on Friday, almost twice as strong as expected, feeding fears that inflation may be a bit more stubborn than the Federal Reserve had hoped it to be when it cut its interest rate by a half a percent.
And then earnings season gets underway, third quarter earnings reports. And is there kind of an overall theme that analysts are looking for in the third quarter, especially with their forward-looking guidance?
Yeah, I think, any kind of certainty, visibility is going to be a key word here, because in order to get to 2025, not only do we have to get through what the Federal Reserve is going to do in November, we have to get through the election cycle here. We have to get through what we hope to be a clean and efficient transition of government, of whatever that may be. And then corporate America can really look at how it's going to be shaping up on its balance sheets in 2025. There's a lot of noise in the market is what I'm trying to say here, Rob. And a lot of that noise, at least right now, is really focused on the economy side as opposed to individual earnings for these companies.
Tom Hudson, financial journalist based in Miami. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, the impact of skimpflation at grocery stores and other areas of the economy.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Some companies are downsizing products or cutting quality while keeping the price the same. And that practice extends beyond the grocery store. We're joined by Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter. Jennifer, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us today. The term shrinkflation has been bandied about for the last couple of years since inflation really took off in earnest at the end of 2021. President Biden used that in a series of social media posts about the size of your Super Bowl snacks getting smaller earlier this year. So we know about shrinkflation, but now there is something called skimpflation, where the product quality goes down while the price remains the same.
Exactly. And it's much more insidious than shrinkflation, because it is it compromises the quality, and you might not notice it at first. You might, you see it a lot. And in fact, with things, one example of it is cocoa butter used in chocolate is now being replaced with palm oil, for example, which is significantly cheaper. So you see some of that stuff happening, but it's really much harder to spot. And you also see it. You see it a lot in food, and in any kind of, the shrinkflation, of course, is when you have a cereal box that once was maybe 10 ounces that now is 8.7 or something like that, or where you're getting less for the same price. But the skimpflation is where they're really compromising the quality, and you see it all across the board, all across industries. You see it in food products, but you also see it at hotels where you might not get your room cleaned every day. That sometimes is a labor issue, but it's also a way for them to save money. And you also see it, like, think about the airlines. 20 years ago, you can get on a plane and get a pillow and get a blanket and something nice to eat, and they'll still have leg room and elbow room and not have to pay for your baggage and other things. That's an example of skimpflation. It's just, reducing quality. And this is not new either, Rob. This goes back 100 years ago, but it also goes back to World War II, when the government had frozen prices and they had rationing coupons and all that. I'm sure you don't remember that, but it was obviously not a very popular program. But what it did was, because the supply was short on so many things, you saw, and meat was a big one, you saw a lot of them start to compromise the quality of the products.
And the irony back then was, because of all of the production shortages that were taking place during World War II, to make sure that America's industrial capacity was devoted to building weapons that can be used overseas, there was a great deal of pent-up consumer demand when the war was over, and that led to a huge bout of inflation, which takes us to the conversation we're having now about skimpflation.
Exactly.
But you mentioned the airlines, and that was a situation where you go back 30 years, and there was a lot more stuff included in the price of your ticket. And now, I think just because the price competition is so fierce, a lot of the stuff that used to be included in your fare is now an add-on, but your base fare is a lot lower. And it seems that the airline passenger, as much as they grumble about how things used to be better in the good old days, they live with that. They accept it. They're fine with the fact that they can get from one part of the country to another in a matter of hours. And where do the consumer say that's okay, and where does the consumer fight back?
Well, the consumer can fight back by not flying or not doing anything. This is also a form of what's called stealth inflation, and that's where prices rise without any explanation. And the airlines is another example, because then there's add-on fees, like for baggage, for example. And let's look at the baggage fees. They were $35, last year, and now they're $40. And that's things like that. But you're also looking at other kinds of fees, like now restaurants are adding a 3% to a total tab to cover credit card processing fees. This is stealth inflation. You're paying extra for things, but you don't know exactly why all the time, and you don't notice it all the time.
Jennifer Waters, Chicago-based business reporter, thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, we'll help you land a new job if you're looking.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Whether it's in person or virtual, a job interview is usually the key to getting the position. Let's get some tips on getting the gig from Michelle Reisdorf, Chicago jobs expert with the Robert Half Company in Chicago. Michelle, thank you for joining us today. And a lot of the tips that you can pass along to help someone ace that job interview or at the very least make a good impression are tips that can help you succeed in life as well as in the job interview.
Absolutely. You know, all of the things are things that we all learn probably in some college course along the way or with a great, you know, parental guidance. But they apply time and time again for every job that you apply for, as well as, like you said, multiple situations in life.
For example, you know, look the person in the eye, whether it is actually in an office or in a conference room somewhere or virtually, look the person in the eye and just know how to carry on a conversation. And those seem like two basic bits of Emily Post behavior that can help you in that job interview.
Absolutely. You know, with more and more of it becoming a digital age and, you know, just a lot of students even going through pandemic times where they weren't sitting in a classroom or, you know, looking at instructors eye to eye or having good conversational skills, we're learning that we oftentimes have to really coach up candidates to prepare them for that interview, whether virtually or in person, because these are things that they just haven't experienced over the last several years. You know, just like all of us learned, I remember I learned, have a good firm handshake. You know, how many people learn that anymore nowadays? And so those are all key things that will get you anywhere in life.
And then some other things you see about, especially people who are just going into the working world for the first time and they just don't know how to do it. So they do a lot of silly things. They bring their parents along for the job interview. They refuse to turn the camera on if it is a Zoom interview. And they also dress unprofessionally. Define unprofessional.
Well, you know, unprofessional is, I guess, knowing what the company's dress code is and then dressing slightly above that. So even if you're interviewing, let's say, for a manufacturing environment where it's a very casual dress code, I would still come business casual or, you know, dressed so that you're slightly above and show that you care about your appearance. You know, I had two interviews this week where both respondents showed up in fully suited with a tie, and we're not even any longer a fully formal suited environment. But I was so impressed out of the gate. In fact, one of the interviews was this morning, and I commented to the young gentleman, I am very impressed that you are fully suited in a tie on a Monday morning. You know, kudos to you. That gives you extra points before the interviews even started.
Also, I feel virtual interviews makes that a little bit easier because not too long ago, Michelle, I was the MC of a small business presentation. And this was back in the days when everything was done virtually. And it was live. I was on vacation. It was from the rec room of the beach house that we rented. And I had a dress shirt on, a tie, sport coat, that's all you could see in the video window,
right?
And then shorts on underneath. So I feel
exactly.
Like even if you are casual, you know, be business on the where they can see you.
Yes, absolutely. Set that good first impression. It's so critical right now to, you know, landing the job that you want because you show up that you care.
And then lastly, and very quickly, do your research, know what the company does, know who you're talking to, because there's nothing more embarrassing than if you say, it's my lifelong dream to work at this place, and then you get the name wrong.
Right, exactly. And or you're asking questions that the answers could have been found on the website. And so absolutely do your research. And most importantly, I would close with send a thank you note. Regardless of whether you want that job or not, send a thank you note, just like showing up dressed professionally. It really adds that little extra touch.
Michelle Reisdorf, Chicago jobs expert with the Robert Half Company in Chicago. Thank you for joining us today.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Mayor Johnson unveils his picks to replace the recently resigned school board. Hurricane Milton is powering up as it heads toward Florida. Next month's election could trigger some cases of traveling fever. It's Stock Picker Monday. We'll get a couple of suggestions from an investing pro. WBBM Business. The markets are lower. The Dow is down 262 points. The NASDAQ is down 95. The S&P 500 is down 28. We have 62 degrees right now in Chicago under sunny skies going up to 69. It's 12:31, topping our news at the half hour. Mayor Johnson has named seven new appointees to the Chicago Board of Education, replacing the panel's entire membership, which resigned on Friday. Those chosen include Margarita Ramirez. She's a former Chicago Public Schools teacher and the mother of 35th Ward Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who's a Johnson ally. 41 of the 50 city council members have signed a letter calling for a hearing before the new board members are seated. Older persons do not have the power to override the appointments. Hurricane Milton is now a supercharged Category 4 storm and heading in the direction of the same areas pounded by Hurricane Helene. This is CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson.
We're looking at 8 to 12 inches of rain and then really sort of in a tight area, let's say about 20 to 30 miles from the center of the storm, you'll be dealing with those winds that will really be damaging property. So that's over 100 miles an hour. Further out from that, you'll get hurricane force winds, and then we'll have a much larger tropical storm force wind field.
Milton is forecast to reach the Florida panhandle by Wednesday night or early Thursday. It's 12:32 as the noon business hour continues. Markets are lower once again. Joining us on the Village of Bedford Park business line, reminding you to bring your business home, is Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist with B. Riley Financial in New York. Art, thank you for joining us today. And a couple of things are pressuring the markets on this Monday afternoon, starting with the fact that the yield on the 10-year Treasury yield has popped above 4% for the first time in a couple of months. And what is driving that activity in the bond market?
Yeah, I would say this. It's one of those nuances where the 10-year tends to be a reflection of the pace of economic activity. And, you know, that obviously fell a bit when we saw the Fed cut rates by 50 basis points back in September, as did the 2-year. But now it feels as though the economic data that we've received since that meeting has certainly been robust, whether you look at the services PMIs or certainly last week's jobs report. So I think that there was a bit of an overreaction to the downside on yields. We're bouncing a bit here. I don't think we're going to make a new high, certainly. I think we're going to make a lower high in this particular go-round. But that is slowing enthusiasm for equities a little bit. I think the other piece of the puzzle, Rob, you're probably going to bring up is rising energy prices. We got WTI is up 12 or 13% on the month, and it's, you know, luckily it started from a lower base. We had $68 WTI just 2 weeks ago, and now we're looking at, call it $77, and that's really a reflection of a fear of disruption of supply coming out of the increased tensions in the Middle East.
And at that point, where in the oil price cycle does there have to be a clear and definitive all clear signal that maybe tensions won't be ratcheted up any higher before we see a reduction in the price of oil?
Yeah, I think that that's it. I think that, you know, we know that the tensions are increasing. The attacks are going back and forth. If we lose some Iranian production in this, I think that at least for a short period of time, you'd see a bump up in energy prices, which would have no economic benefit. It's not coming from increased demand where we think global GDP is picking up. It's coming from a disruption of supply. The good news here is Saudi Arabia's got some excess supply that they could bring back online, probably close to 2 million barrels a day. Iran's got about 2.5 or 3 million barrels a day in the pipeline now, most of that going to China. So I think this is a temporary move. And oddly enough, with this 12% pop we've seen in the last month or so, that just brings us back to where the WTI average is for the whole year. So we're right about where we've been for most of the year. We had a bit of a sell-off into the 60s. So we're kind of normalizing the price. I think for that to pull back down, we'd certainly need to see an all-clear or at least some kind of near-term ceasefire in the Middle East.
We will get the meeting, the minutes from the last Fed meeting, the one where they cut rates by a half a percentage point. And is that a situation where you're looking for clues about their thinking about the next interest rate cut? And maybe just because of the latest data, that is literally and figuratively yesterday's news?
It really feels like it, doesn't it? I think that the conversation around the table probably had more to do with the fact that they would have gone in July 25 basis points if they had the data that came out a week after their meeting. So had they gone 25 basis points in July, they likely would have gone 25 basis points in September. I don't know that there's going to be much about what November looks like, only because there's about 7 weeks in between meetings. So I really think this is all about the reasons behind the 50 basis points and why they decided to go with that versus 25 basis points, which seems to be the new consensus for the cadence of rate cuts.
And then very quickly, earnings season gets underway. What are analysts looking for, especially as far as forward guidance is considered?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this. So if you look at the estimates for the S&P 500 for this quarter, it's high single digits. We'll likely beat that as we usually do. And then hopefully guidance keeps us in the low double digits for the fourth quarter, which is where consensus is right now. I think any degradation to that fourth quarter estimate likely would cause a bit of a sell-off in the market, but that's certainly not a prediction. We think earnings are still very strong as GDP is growing at about 3% right now.
Art Hogan, Chief Market Strategist, B. Riley Financial in New York. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up next, heading out of the country because you don't like an election result. We'll talk about that next.
Compounding your interest with an economy of words. This is the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
As Election Day approaches, you've likely heard someone threaten to leave the country if their candidate doesn't win. Let's discuss election exile with Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher of JoeSentMe.com, based in New York. Joe, thank you for joining us today. And of course, I'm not supposed to do this as a neutral journalist, but I'll tell you about the one election that really did break my heart, Joe. And that was, I was in second grade, and the school children of Illinois were asked to vote on an official state fish. And I voted for the channel catfish, and the bluegill won. And I wanted to move to Indiana, Joe, but my parents said, no, we live in Chicago. That's where our jobs are, and you got to learn to live with it. But how many people have actually up and left the country if their person didn't win? I'm only aware of one person who did that, and that was Pierre Salinger, the former Kennedy White House spokesperson, actually moved to France after George Bush was reelected. But it seems like how many people actually follow through on that threat?
Well, it's hard to tell, Rob, although this has historical precedents well before Pierre Salinger and well before your fish fan, Todd. People will remember from the history classes that Aaron Burr left the country when Thomas Jefferson didn't make him vice president again. He went off to the Louisiana Territory and tried to start his own country. So there's something in the American psyche that says, okay, if we don't get what we want, we leave. And it's been happening more since, I don't know, probably going back to the first Obama. So if you can look at that arc in the last 16 years, there's been more people at least saying they're leaving. It's hard to tell who leaves and why. But clearly it's on people's mind. Some people think about it.
Well, also knowing the way Aaron Burr met his end, maybe he had problems above and beyond not being named the vice president. But that's a conversation for another day and maybe another musical. But if you want to leave the country, though, Joe, you got to kind of figure out what countries align with your political disappointment. I mean, a lot of liberals fantasize about moving to Canada or Western Europe, some type of social democracy. And where do conservatives want to go, let's say, if Kamala Harris wins less than a month from today?
Well, it's interesting, Rob. I didn't look at it. This comes from my column that's up on Joe Sent Me right now. I didn't look at it that way. I just look at the best places to go to if you want to be an expat American. Canada is always popular because, A, it's close. They kind of sort of speak English. Except for Quebec. And I guess you might not like their gun laws, but otherwise, the cost of living is pretty good. If you go to somewhere like Vancouver, where admittedly the costs are high, the weather's good year-round, you never really get snow or ice. Mexico is always popular. Panama seems to be the country of the moment, according to the people who, follow the expat trends. Although Ecuador is also getting some play simply because the cost of living is so low. But there, of course, you'd have to learn how to speak Spanish.
Now, could you also potentially, are there tours available where you could just do the disillusioned American author tour? And, you know, let's say you don't like the results of the election and you say to yourself, you know what, this is a good a time as any to drop out of society and really just lose myself in French cafe life. Is it very easy to immigrate to France and just become a jaded Parisian?
Well, it depends on how you want to do it. If you want to do it legally, it's pretty tough. Even getting to Canada and getting residency is fairly difficult. But if you just go on a tourist visa and overstay, like in the United States, they don't pay a lot of attention. And I assume you're only going for the 4 years you're unhappy. But if you're serious about this, you might want to Google expat companies. There are companies that actually help you. And obviously, a place you might go to is a place you've gone to and loved as a holiday, although, frankly, it's never the same. The other thing you might look at is going back to, as my joke line was, go back where you came from, at least where your ancestors came from. If you're Irish, if you're Polish, if you're Italian, there are actual programs where they want you to come back. Most countries actually have a sort of citizenship for ancestors. So you might want to look at that. Go back to the old country.
Of course, the last thing is, if you leave the country, that is kind of a permanent move. But coalitions are always changing and always shifting. And if you hypothetically left the country when George W. Bush was reelected 20 years ago, I'm sure your mind would be blown at the idea that his vice president would be endorsing the Democrat running two decades down the line. So if you want to go, just know that nothing is permanent in America. In politics.
Absolutely nothing is permanent. And I got a lot of emails from the members of the Joe Semi website saying, I'm sticking it out and I'm going to fight. And they didn't say, I think I did a good job because no one told me which side they were going to fight for. So I think people talk a better game than they do. But if you want to go, just think about it as a 4 year, really long vacation.
Joe Brancatelli, editor and publisher of JoeSentMe.com. Thank you for joining us today.
It's 60 Minutes of Financial Planning. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Stock Picker Monday, and helping us out this afternoon is Chris Everett, fiduciary financial planner and president of Everett Wealth Solutions in Forest Park, author of the book, The Prescription for a Healthy Retirement. Chris, thank you for joining us today. Two selections, and your first one is a tried and true name in the technology space.
How about that? IBM. You know, so many investors don't even think of AI, you know, artificial intelligence when they think about IBM. But boy, they have been turning their ship in that direction for quite a while now. And their focus has been on enterprise class corporate customers, the big guys. And right now, IBM is already recording some pretty stellar sales in the AI space. Do you remember that movie, The War Games?
Oh, yeah.
You know, where they're,
Let's play Global Thermonuclear War.
Perfect, right? So the name of that computer was Watson. So now their new AI generative platform is called Watson X. So it's only been around for about a year, but it has already like $2 billion in signed contracts. So I'm pretty excited about that. I think this entire area still has so much further to go, and so I'd highly recommend IBM as a play if you want to get in the AI space.
And then the next one is in the world of energy.
How about nuclear energy as a power play? So Investors Business Daily just put out an article. We have this too, but Constellation Energy is a nuclear power giant. You know, earnings are beginning really to power up as electricity prices surge. You know, and I look at our country, our electrical grid is a hot mess. And so I think there's going to be a whole lot more money poured into this entire electrical area, and certainly alongside of the nuclear power play. Back on September 20th, it announced plans to restart Unit 1 of the Three Mile Island nuclear plant, aiming to bring that back online in 2028, rather. And they have a 20-year deal to sell all its power to Microsoft, because you know what a power suck that takes. So this is a strong play, and I think if you're a trader or not a trader, you're running your own portfolio, take a look at this huge gap that happened on September 19th. So maybe you don't, you know, pile up in this stock now, but put something down in at the gap level, which is like around the $219 range, because today it's trading at $282.
Chris Everett, fiduciary financial planner and president, Everett Wealth Solutions in Forest Park. Her selections, IBM, ticker symbol IBM, and Constellation Energy, CEG.